There once was a poll conducted by Newsweek that claimed we believe in miracles. And this was some of the actual percentages of the research that they did. Those who believe in divine miracles, 84%. Those who believe in the reality of miracles as described in the Bible, 79%. Those who have had a personal experience with miracles, 48%. Those who know of people who have experienced miracles, 63%. Those who have prayed for a miracle, 67%. Those who believe that God or the saints heal people who have been given no chance of survival by medical doctors, 77%. See, almost all of us believe in miracles. And according to this poll, almost all of us have had at least some experience or know someone who's had a personal experience with a miracle. And I would have to say I'm certainly one of those people. Me and my wife certainly are. If you ever come to my house, you'll notice that on the longest wall in our living room, it's just totally covered with all these different objects. And the objects are all point in a story that tells the story of how God brought us miraculously from our home in Alberta to this place. And among all the objects, the one that stands out the most, and actually I probably should have brought a picture of it, but if you come to my house, I'll tell you the story and you'll see it. The point is that it's very obvious, so it prompts a storytelling. But out of all the objects on the wall, there's three things that stand out the most. And that is three very large date plates. And they're like plates that have specific dates on them. And each one of those dates is the date of when God performed a very huge, obvious miracle in our lives in response to a specific prayer that was needed to bring us here. And so when people come in, I kind of tell that story and I say, see, this is God at work. This is how he performed a miracle. And a miracle, when I say that, maybe it conjures up different ideas in your mind. I think it means different things to different people. So one needs to understand, what do we mean by a miracle? The dictionary describes it as an effect or extraordinary event in the physical world that surpasses human or natural powers. Basically, I think miracles are things that exceed, as I said, human and natural powers, natural explanation. In other words, they are things that are outside of our control, right? And that's really why I think we ask for miracles in those times in our lives when things are outside of our control, right? When our lives or situation seems beyond our ability to do anything about and we seem totally hopeless, that's when we start praying for a miracle, like 67% of everyone, according to statistics. And when these miracles do occur, the interesting thing about a miracle is it has this amazing way of bolstering our faith in God. Why is that? Well, because we knew that we couldn't do this thing, and then God showed up. So therefore, it proves to us that God is real, he exists, he cares about our problems, and he is powerful to do that which he wants to do. And the story of Gideon that we've been looking at for a few weeks, it's very much a story of faith and trusting in God and a story of miracles. This is our third week of talking about the story of Gideon from the Bible. If you're new to us today, if this is your first time, don't worry. We'll catch you up. You haven't missed anything if you missed the first two. But when we left Gideon last week, basically, and just to give a little background, he was sort of a leader of Israel about 3,000 years ago, of this nation of God's people. And he was risen up by God to free his people from foreign oppressors that had been subjugating them at the time. And when we left Gideon last week, he was in sort of a precarious situation. A situation that called for a miracle because it was a situation that was outside of his control and outside of his ability. If you recall, Gideon was asked to lead the whole nation, right, against the Midianites. And the Midianites were a nation that was more numerous, more powerful, and as the passage tells us, they were much more equipped than the Israelites. Like, they had chariots and stuff, which is like the equivalent to like tanks these days. So they had better equipment and that kind of stuff. And it was a hopeless kind of a situation. So Gideon is left in this kind of very hopeless situation. And you think, well, maybe he's a great man of power and authority, but he wasn't. As we know, he was the weakest out of all of Israel, which means he was the least qualified to do anything about this. He commanded the least authority to be able to rally the troops, so to speak. He was a weak, weak person. And so it begs the question, how is God going to accomplish this impossibly large task with this impossibly weak man? And the answer is, God can do it, but Gideon can't. Gideon has no hope. He is in a situation where he must trust in God fully and totally put his faith in him. But we see time and time again in the story, Gideon is not just a weak man, he is a man of weak faith. His faith isn't strong and he doubts God time and time again, even though God helps him out. And as we saw last week, speaks to him in an audible voice. I mean, who can say that God spoke to him in an audible voice? Yet he still doubts, right? And so what does Gideon do when he's in this situation where we left off last week and God just spoke to him and audibly and revealed himself to him? Well, he does what anyone, I guess, would do in that situation. He asks for more. He asks for a miracle. And this is where we pick up in the story in Judges chapter 6, beginning in verse 16. It says, "The Lord answered, 'I will be with you, and you will strike down all the Midianites, leaving none alive.' Gideon replied, 'If now I have found favor in your eyes, give me a sign that it's really that it's you that's talking to me. Please do not go away until I come back and bring my offering and set it before you.' And the Lord said, 'I will wait until you return.' Gideon went inside, prepared a young goat and an ephah of flour, and he made bread without yeast, putting the meat in a basket and its broth in a pot. He brought them out and he offered them to him under the yoke. The angel of God said to him, 'Take the meat and the unleavened bread, place them on this rock and pour out the broth.' And Gideon did so. And the angel of God touched the meat and the unleavened bread with the tip of the staff that was in his hand. And fire flared from the rock, consuming the meat and the bread. And the angel of the Lord disappeared. Then Gideon realized that it was the angel of the Lord. And he exclaimed, 'Alas, sovereign Lord, I have seen the angel of the Lord face to face.' But the Lord said to him, 'Peace. Do not be afraid. You're not going to die.' So Gideon built an altar to the Lord there and called it, 'The Lord is Peace.' To this day, it stands at Ophrah of the Abiezrites. That same night, the Lord said to him, 'Take the second bull from your father's herd, the one 7 years old. Tear down your father's altar to Baal and cut down the Asherah pole beside it. Then build a proper kind of altar to the Lord your God on top of its height, using the wood of the Asherah pole that you cut down. Offer the second bull as a burnt offering.' So Gideon took 10 of his servants and did as the Lord told him. But because he was afraid of his family and the townspeople, he did it at night rather than in the day." So what we see here, we see that God has bolstered Gideon's faith, right, by showing him a miracle, right? Gideon says, "Show me a sign that it's you," sends the angel of the Lord, consumes the wet offering into fire. Quite an amazing feat that he does. And then God does what he does, is after he increases your faith a little bit, he then puts your faith to the test. And he asks Gideon to go out and do the first act of doing what he's ultimately asked him to do, which is lead the people into victory militarily over the Midianites. And so he says, go and desecrate the idols of the foreign gods. Now Gideon goes and he does this, but he still lacks faith. You can see his faith is still wavering, because it said he did it at night rather in the daytime because he was afraid of his family and he was afraid of the people. You see, fear is always going to show our lack of faith, right? To the degree which you lack faith is the degree to which you're going to be afraid. But he did it anyways. And despite this witnessing of a miracle, we see that Gideon is still weak, right? He still, despite all odds, is still lacking trust in God that he really is going to do what he said he's going to do. But as we will see, God, time and time again in the story, is gracious to Gideon. Oh, he's so gracious to him. And he's patient with him. And he provides whatever he needs to build up his faith a little bit more, a little bit more. So let's continue reading now in verse 28. "In the morning, when the people of the town got up, there was Baal's altar demolished with the Asherah pole beside it, cut down, and the second bull sacrificed on the newly built altar. They asked each other, 'Who did this?' When they carefully investigated, they were told, Gideon, the son of Joash, did it. The people of the town demanded of Joash, 'Bring out your son. He must die because he has broken down Baal's altar and cut down the Asherah pole beside it.' But Joash replied to the hostile crowd around him, Are you going to plead Baal's case? Are you trying to save him? Whoever fights for him shall be put to death by the morning. If Baal is really a good god, he can defend himself when someone breaks down his altar. So because Gideon broke down Baal's altar, they gave him the name of Jerubbaal that day, saying, let Baal contend with him. So here the people of the town, they discover here that indeed it was Gideon who defiled the altar and cut down the pole and made the sacrifice to God. Now you need to realize that this is a pretty serious crime. It doesn't seem like a big deal to us, but in those days this would have been one of the most egregious crimes that you could have done. Like you should have been punished by death, and maybe that punishment would have even trickled down to the rest of your family. But what happens here? Gideon essentially gets off scot-free. Does the worst crime, and he gets off scot-free. Clearly, God is protecting him, right? It's very clear. It would have been clear to Gideon that God is providing for him, and he is willing to step up and do what's necessary to make sure that Gideon can do what he's called him. He's fulfilling his promise to Gideon, so to speak. And so Gideon's faith, I think, through this experience is strengthened just a little bit. And so God does what he does when he strengthens our faith. He then puts it to the test, and he calls him to a slightly bigger task this time. Let's continue in verse 33. Now all the Midianites, Amalekites, and the other Eastern people joined forces and crossed over the Jordan and camped in the valley of Jezreel. Then the Spirit of the Lord came on Gideon, and he blew a trumpet, summoning the Abizarites to follow him. He sent messengers throughout Manasseh, calling them to arms, and also into Asher, Zebulun, and Naphtali. So they too all went up and met with him. Gideon said to God, if you will save Israel by my hand, as you have promised, look, I will place a wool fleece on the threshing floor. If there is dew only on the fleece and all the ground is dry, then I will know that you will save Israel by my hand, as you said. And that is what happened. Gideon rose early the next day. He squeezed the fleece and wrung up the dew, a bowl full of water. Then Gideon said to God, do not be angry with me. Let me make just one more request. Allow me one more test with the fleece, but this time make the fleece dry and let the ground be covered with dew. That night God did so. Only the fleece was dry and all the ground was covered with dew. So interesting, as the story unravels here, what we see is that Gideon is being tested. He's being asked to summon the people together, right, to start doing this. So he's starting to do what God has told him he's going to do through him. That is, gather the people and go to war against the Midianites. So he blows the trumpet. But realize here that Gideon isn't doing this by his own ability. He's being very graciously helped by God, because it said that the Spirit of the Lord came on him. Some translations say the Spirit of God clothed Gideon. I don't know exactly what that means, but it probably meant he supernaturally empowered Gideon for this task and gave him sort of favor in the eyes of the people that they would actually respond to him when he said, come on, join me to this thing. He wasn't a great leader, remember that. And so he's assisted by God, and still his faith is wavering, right? So God's already starting to do what he said he was going to do. He's fulfilling his promises. And Gideon says, okay, well, can you give me another sign? And so he asks for a sign, and God gives him another sign. And then what does he do? He asks for another sign after that sign is done. I mean, at this point, you have to say to yourself, like, come on, man. I mean, God's done so much. He's been so faithful to you. He's given you every provision time and time again, and you're asking for another one. That'd be like someone giving you a car and then you demanding that the tank be full. You know, like, it's a little bit rude, I think, at this point. Yet God in the story is patient with Gideon. Realize Gideon is not the protagonist in the story. He is weak, he is failing, he is untrusting, and God is patient, and he is good, and he is faithful again and again. And so he's going through this cycle, the same cycle that Israel goes through, of mistrust, and God goes through the cycle of faithfulness and patience, because he's a good, perfect father. And what we need to see is that God is being overly generous, overly gracious to Gideon, right? He doesn't have to be, yet he's doing this to give him every single advantage to trust in him, right? He speaks to him in an audible voice, asks him to do the impossible, which you would think is a bad thing, but actually it's helpful in building trust in God, because when God asks you to do something that's too big for you to do on your own, then it forces you to put your trust in Him. So Gideon's placed in a situation where he's almost forced to trust in God. So God is helping him to trust Him, right? Secondly, He speaks to him, He sends an angel. Angel performs a miracle for Gideon to see. He's helping to bolster his trust. Then he meets almost certain death at the hands of the townspeople. God protects him from any harm. Then He empowers him by His very spirit to do that which He's called him to do. Then He fulfills His promise to actually have the people respond to Him and follow His leadership. And then on top of that, He performs two more miracles at Gideon's request. And He does all this to impart on Gideon the faith that clearly he doesn't have. And yet, as we're going to see even next week as we continue on with the story and we finish the story, Gideon was still afraid after all this to attack the Midianites. He still lacked trust in God. Despite all of this, he doesn't believe that God is a God who keeps His promises to His people. And all of this we see not just in Gideon, but also in the story of Israel through all the book of Judges. You know, it's repeated again and again. Lack of trust, lack of trust, lack of trust. Even though God does everything to warrant trust in Him. And so I want to, at this point, turn it around a little bit and personalize it for us and say, how many of us has God been gracious enough to do great things in your life, to show Himself to you, to prove He's faithful? How many miracles have you witnessed? You know, for us, for me and my wife Lacey, it's been quite many. I remember the first really big one He did is we were in second year college and we were in love. We're still in love, but we were madly in love at that time. A different sort of a hot love, I guess you could call it. All right, I digress. So we wanted nothing more than just to get married, you know, like two lovebirds. We just wanted to get married, but our families wanted a wedding. And weddings, well, they're expensive. It costs money. We didn't have any money. Our families didn't have any money. In fact, we were living on student loans. We had taken 100% of all we could from student loans just to get by because our families didn't have any money to help us with college. And so we're totally strapped, and now they want a wedding, and I get it. And so we're trying to plan this wedding. And planning was a struggle, too, because realize, like, we're young at this point. We just are just learning how to, like, live on our own aside from our parents, like, buy groceries, do the dishes. And remember, we would fill the dishwasher up with laundry detergent or soap, and it would bubble everywhere. Whatever, I don't know. But we fill up with something, and bubbles would fill the whole place, and we'd flood. Anyways, we were just figuring this out. We got to plan a wedding on top of this. It was so difficult. There were so many challenges, and we thought there's no way we can do this on our own. But we believed that God wanted us to do that, and He'd called us to be together. And so we said, we're going to trust, and we're going to do it. And somehow, beyond all odds, we somehow paid for a wedding and a honeymoon, and we were able to plan it all, and it all went off without a hitch. And truly, I think for us, that was a miracle. You know, some people may not define that as a miracle, but for us who were in the situation, it certainly was a miracle. And that for us was sort of that watershed moment. And I think we all have those in our lives, those watershed times where God really showed up in a big way, and we point back to it. So when we find ourselves in very precarious situations later in life and things are really difficult, we look back to that and we say, well, remember that time? And it bolsters our faith. And that's our experience. I remember so many times when we were in bad situations and I would say to Lacey, or Lacey would say to me, and she'd say, remember that time? Remember when we had like no money and we had no idea how to plan a wedding, and yet somehow we paid for the whole thing and everything was fine? And I was like, yeah, that's right. We trusted in God. And that kind of gives us a little bit of faith to move on. But to say, I think, that we were totally faithful, that would be misleading. I don't want to misrepresent ourselves as better than we are, because believe me, we struggled. We lacked trust in God in that process and even afterwards. Like, we worried constantly about money. And we worked our butt off and we tried to plan and all these things. We trusted in God a little bit, but really we did not fully trust in God that He was actually going to come through, even when He did. He really performed a miracle in our lives, and He has performed like so many miracles since that time. Yet despite all this, when we find ourselves in difficult times, me and my wife, we still find ourselves struggling. struggling to trust in God, struggling to give Him our all and to say He's going to take care of us like He did before. And I think this is like with all of us, right? As people, we can never fully trust in God in the way that we should. Right? We're always failing to trust in Him, even though He's so gracious to us and so good to us. And there's so many reasons, even from Scripture itself, which shows us the history of our ancestors and how He's been faithful to them, like Gideon and Israel time and time again. And I've been saying these last few weeks, I know I've been saying, trust in God. I've been imploring you, trust in God more, trust in God, trust in God. And indeed, we should trust in God more. But I also want us to see that we can never fully trust in God the way that we should. We'll always fail. We'll always fail. We'll never be faithful to God in the way that we need to, in the way that we ought to, in the way that's necessary. But, as a big but, there is one who was. And His name is Jesus. See, Jesus was perfectly faithful to God in every way. And He went to the cross, and that was the ultimate act of faith. He had to trust in God that that was part of His divine plan. And He was going to be faithful, and He was going to come through. As we know, His faith was proven right because He rose again on the third day. God was faithful to Him. And He is the perfect Gideon. He is the perfect Israel. You have to realize that, right? Gideon and Israel, those are like archetypes of us, of people in general, of how we fail again and again and again. And just like the Israelites, if we were given an infinity amount of do-overs, we would still fail to trust in God in the way that's necessary. That's why we needed Jesus, to be our representative, one who truly did trust in God 100% the way that was necessary for righteousness. The victory, my friends, therefore, has been won for us, not because of our faith, because of the faith of Christ Jesus for us. And it's through His faith we have faith. It is His faith onto us. Don't you see that? It's because He was faithful unto death that we don't have to be. And because He was faithful unto death for us, only then can we be. It's in what God has done for us, it's not what we do. And this is the central teaching of the Christian message. This is, in a nutshell, the gospel. That it's what He has done for us, not what we have done. And I'm constantly, as a parent, struggling and wondering and trying to figure out, how do I teach this to my children? To be crass, how do I indoctrinate my children? Remember, I had a little to-do list on. I have like all these lists. I'm a list guy, so my phone, I have all these lists. And one of them for the longest time was like, figure out how to indoctrinate children. Figure out how to indoctrinate children. And I'm constantly struggling with this because much of what I see when it comes to attempts to communicate Jesus to the children is trying to teach them to know Bible stories or teach them certain moral principles. And I get that's all well-meaning and stuff, but the story of Noah is not a story about rainbows and sharing. Though, like, believe me, I don't know how you get that out of that, but people figure out a way. And you can get that out of the story of Noah if you really work at it. And I think, is this what it's about? I really want to communicate to my children, at the very least, if nothing else, the basic gospel of Jesus. And I pray to God. That's my new thing. It's like, I don't even know. And I've just been praying to God that He'd be gracious. And I've been telling Lacey, I said, I think with this parenting thing, especially with spirituality, because I know spirituality is our job. The school's not going to teach that to them. It's our job as a parent to take leadership with our children in terms of their spirituality. I said, I don't know. I'm struggling and I'm messing up. We just got to pray for God's grace. And a few weeks ago, God was very gracious to me because Lacey was out one night and I was home with the kids and it was supper time. And I've said this before, get ready for this. It's one of these kids' stories. Everyone loves my kids' stories because they're really funny. Because if you know my kids, they're funny kids. But there's two things in this world you cannot make a child do. You cannot make them eat and you cannot make them go to sleep. Which makes bedtime and supper time like the most frustrating times for a parent. Like, you wouldn't believe it. So Lacey's gone one night and Titus is not eating his food for whatever reason. Doesn't like what's on the menu. And I don't know. I'm feeling good about myself then. I have lots of energy. So, like, you know what? I'm going to put the gloves on metaphorically. And I'm going to fight him on this one. You know? Let's see where this goes. So I'm like, I'm going to wait him out. So I start by trying to wait him out. It escalates very quickly to the point where I'm taking away privileges and timing him out. And I'm kind of pulling out all the stops here. And he starts, you know, really getting heated. And he probably gets more heated than I've ever seen him in his entire life. He's screaming, he's crying, he's starting to knock things over and, like, destroy things, which is very rare for Titus. Usually you don't see him get, like physical like that. And I'm starting to get heated, and I can feel, you know, my anger starting to rise, and I feel like I'm losing control of the situation, and I don't want to capitulate, I don't want to give in, and yet fighting with him isn't working, it's going to a bad place, and I feel very out of control at this point. And I'm sure as parents, you've all been there at one point, if you are a parent, and I feel very out of control. And this moment where I felt like I was just going to lose it, like God was gracious to me. And in that moment, the Spirit came on me, like did with Gideon. And he showed me that this was a teachable moment. And that he wanted me to show a third way. Not give in, not, you know, law, but there was a third way, a Jesus way. The way of the gospel of grace. And I was supposed to show that to him. And so I knew what I had to do. And I got April, because she was loving this, right? She loves it when Titus is, like, in trouble and losing it. So she was happy as could be. And I got April, and I said, April, let's go and get the Bible. So we got the toddler Bible, we call it. And we turned open to the picture of the three crosses, that story. And we went downstairs, and we showed that story to Titus. We said, remember the story of Jesus and on the cross and the three crosses? And he said, yeah. And I unbuttoned my shirt, and I showed him my tattoo. I have just a simple cross tattoo here on my chest. And I said, you know what this is? And he says, yeah, that's the cross. Which is progress, because he used to think it was a T for Titus. It's quite self-centered to think that, yes, I got a tattoo because your name starts in a T. But no, it's a cross. And so he gets that now, and he says, that's a cross. And I said, yeah, and that's Jesus on the cross. And I said, the cross, my son, teaches us about grace. And what grace means is that you give someone what they haven't earned. And so April and I have decided that we would like to show you grace. And the rule of the house is you have to always eat your supper. So we said, me and April are going to eat your supper for you. So we got there, and it was gross because it was a little chewed up, and it was cold at this point and kind of mangled. But we ate it, and we ate it lovingly because we loved him. We loved our son, and we didn't want to see him in that state that he was in. And so we ate it, and after we ate his food, he calmed down, and he felt loved. Like, his demeanor totally changed, and he got a treat, and he got to play his choice of game with Daddy, because that's what you get when you eat your dinner in its entirety in our house. That's the law, right? You have to eat it, and when you eat it, you get these things as a result. And I told my kids at that point, I said, I want you to know that this is what Jesus did for you on the cross. He ate all of your cold, gross dinners because you couldn't do it. And he did that for you because he loves you. And that's why we love him. And that's why I'm doing this for you. And it was a lesson that really stuck with my son. I know, because this past week I was with my kids. Lacey was away. And Titus brought it up in there. And I'll tell you that story next week, next Sunday. But it stuck with him. He knew. He remembered that. And he knows what it means now to show grace. And I guess the point I'm trying to make through all this is, when you truly grasp what Jesus did for you on the cross, when you grasp grace, then you can trust in him. Right? Because your heart is melted with a love towards our beautiful Jesus, who did that for us. Well, we didn't have to. He did that because he loved us. Then your heart is melted, and then it's easy to trust after that point. To say, it's easy to trust in one who loves me, because as I've said time and time again, you can trust in a God who's bled for you. You can trust in a God who's died for you. And so I would just like us to give praise to the one who is worthy of all praise and honor and glory because of his goodness to us. Let's pray. Daddy, we love you because you are a perfect father to us. Even though we don't deserve it, and even though we fail you time and time again, even though we kick and we scream and we break things, oh, you are good to us. That you gave your most prized possession, your one and only son, Jesus, to go to the cross for us, and he was totally trusting of you as a perfect son. Oh, Lord, give us the faith of Jesus. As your broken children, would you give us the faith of the perfect perfect child, of the perfect Son, Jesus, who was always able to trust in you even when you asked him to do the most difficult thing, to suffer. We just thank you and we give you all the praise and honor and glory. Holy Spirit, would you take this concept of the grace of God and would you impart it into our heart? For it says in your word in Romans chapter 8 that by your Spirit we cry out, Daddy, Father. For your Spirit communicates with our spirit that we are children of God. So remind us that we are your children, God. Amen.